I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. From Gaza, there are reports of more than 500 people dead in the increasingly intense combat between Israeli soldiers and Hamas militants. Israeli military forces are consolidating their hold on parts of the Gaza Strip in an effort to stop Hamas rocket attacks on the Jewish state. Following air assaults, Israeli ground forces are now on the outskirts of densely populated Gaza City, where troops have seized residential buildings and are fighting street to street and door to door. Today, President Bush said he understands Israel's desire to defend itself and says no peace deal will work unless it forces Hamas to stop its rockets attacks. And tomorrow, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will be in New York asking the UN Security Council to adopt a resolution calling for an immediate and permanent ceasefire. Joining us now from Gaza City is Reuters correspondent Nidal Al-Mughrabi. And Nidal, hello.
Hello, hi.
Thank you for joining us. Give us a sense of what you're seeing. We're hearing reports of intense fighting as Israeli forces push deeper into Gaza. What have you seen?
Yes, we can say that Gaza City is being virtually encircled by Israeli ground forces and in one way or another virtually separated from the rest of the Gaza Strip. The gunfighting today has been intensified, especially in North Gaza Strip and east of the Jabalia camp, also in North Gaza Strip, and east of the Gaza City itself. And it seems that the Israeli operation was intended to be knocking the doors of Gaza City. And Hamas is still firing Grad rockets, which is longer-range rockets. There was a speech by Hamas's spokesman of the armed wing, and he promised that more or thousands others of Israelis will fall within the range of the rocket fire. And he promised that farther cities than Kiryat Malachi or Yavne will also be within the range of the rocket fire. So they are still defiant. And it's not only rhetoric, because we're having statements and reports from the Israeli military and the Israeli police that rockets are continuing to land into Israeli territories.
Nidal, does it appear to you that you say that Gaza City is encircled. Does it appear to you that Israeli forces are going to enter Gaza City? And if so, what would happen then?
Yes, it is being encircled, and Gaza City is a home for 500,000 people. And, you know, it contains one of the largest refugee camps. Two refugee camps are on the range of fire. If the Israeli ground forces come closer into these places, I expect heavy losses on the side of the Palestinians, but also, as even Israeli military experts predicted, that there will be dozens of fatalities among the Israeli army, too.
Mm-hmm. Nidal, we've heard that already there are more than 500 Palestinians killed, including civilians. Now there's concern about a growing humanitarian crisis. Give us a sense of what is happening to the civilian population. What are they facing?
They are already facing lots of hardships. It's not about just the fight. It's about everything. It's about electricity, that they don't have electricity in their houses except for 2 or 3 hours in the day, every 24 hours, if at all, even. And when we say there is no electricity, it means that there is no water as well, because water wells need generators and electricity to pump the water to the houses. And, food is very scarce. If we're talking mainly on flour, rice, and sugar, if you go to one bakery in Gaza, you will find at least 200 to 300 people lining up in a long, endless queue to seek some bread for their children. And families are not even able to afford diapers for their children.
So an increasingly gloomy situation. Meanwhile, French President Nicolas Sarkozy is in Egypt. I guess he's going to be touring the region, trying to broker a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Is anything likely to come out of led by President Sarkozy?
Any kind of a ceasefire must have international guarantees. So far, Israel says it is looking for a complete cessation of rocket fire into Israel. Israel is looking for a complete closure of tunnels between Gaza and Egypt, where Israel suspects Hamas is getting its arsenal. Unclear how this is going to be affordable. The European Union is working on a proposal. I don't think that the proposal is mature yet, and we have seen the presidency of the European Union is saying that they cannot impose a ceasefire, and they say that it's not the moment to do so.
Yeah, so not the moment to do so, so it looks like we're going to see a good deal more fighting still ahead.
Unfortunately, and sad enough, peace isn't working. The only voices that we will be hearing in Gaza is the voices of the gun battles and more of mortar bombs.
Mm. Sad news. Nidal Al-Mughrabi, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Veteran Reuters correspondent Nidal Al-Mughrabi. He spoke to us from Gaza City. As Israeli military forces push deeper into Gaza, there is debate in Israel about the wisdom of this latest military operation. Bernard Avishai joins us now from Jerusalem. He's author of The Hebrew Republic, How Secular Democracy and Global Enterprise Will Bring Israel Peace at Last. He also writes on politics and business for Harper's, among other publications. And Bernie, welcome.
Thank you.
And I want to be clear about something you wrote just today for the Daily Beast. You say that Israel has the right to respond to Hamas rockets fired into Israel, but you say Israel has made a statement with the current operation that will help Hamas. How so?
Well, first of all, I should say that the word statement was not mine. I was quoting someone from Sderot who was saying, you know, it's important for Israel to make a statement. And in fact, that kind of language is what we hear all the time, that, you know, this is important to send Hamas a message. And, you know, frankly, when I hear these epithets, my blood curdles, because sometimes you hear Israeli generals depicting this whole war as if it's a game of psychological chicken, as if it's like some big photo op where you're supposed to be the person who has, over a period of time, done the most damage, killed the most people, and that somehow you come out of this, therefore, having, quote, weakened, embarrassed, humiliated the other side. In fact, you know, it's appropriate to respond and appropriate to think about how to deal with a Hamas group inside of Gaza who have been sending missiles into Israel. And we have to think about what kind of appropriate, proportionate, successful response to make. But in fact, what Israel has done is it's gone in with overwhelming military force. The first week and a half of this has been a little like shooting fish in a barrel. And 500 people have been killed, 500 human beings have been killed, many of whom are civilians, many of whom have been working for the Hamas government only because the government was the only place they could get a job. So a lot of people are getting killed, as it were, to make a statement. I have to say, that's exactly the mentality of Hamas. You see, that's exactly the mentality of Hamas. They send missiles into Israel to make a statement.
So you're saying that by responding in kind or even more forcefully, Israel is going to be pushing the population into the hands of Hamas that otherwise might not have been in their hands.
Not just the population, the entire region. I mean, look, Israel and Palestine together are about the size of greater Los Angeles. They're kind of interlocked city-states. You know, when Israel takes this kind of action in Gaza, it's buying into a vendetta culture, which is exactly the kind of culture Hamas thrives on. Mm. Hamas was nothing 20 years ago. Mm. Hamas is the product of 20 years of political stalemate, 20 years of vendetta on both sides, 20 years of Israel continuing its own settlement project and the Palestinians continuing to adopt rejectionist tactics, which often are terrorist tactics. And this kind of thing has to stop. You don't create a war on terror by creating a terrorist war.
But Bernie, how should Israel have responded? I mean, it does seem that there is a very legitimate concern about rockets raining down on civilian populations. And we've heard some very forceful statements from Israel's political leaders and the U.S. that Israel has a right to defend itself. I mean, it seems like your approach is high-minded and admirable, but you still have the problem of rockets coming down on civilian populations. How should Israel respond to that?
Look, there are all kinds of creative ways of showing that you have overwhelming military force and you won't accept rocket attacks. Mm-hmm. For example, Israel knows the place from which every rocket is launched, knows exactly the coordinates from which every rocket is launched. It could say, every rocket that's launched from Gaza, we will, 1/2 hour later, bomb it. I mean, that hasn't even been tried. Mm-hmm. Give people a chance to get the hell out of there. The problem is that we're already in sort of in the 11th hour of these kinds of vendettas. And then you're asked to say, well, how do you respond to the last attack? You can't solve a problem that needs a generation of creative diplomacy and creative building of civil society and simply say, well, yeah, but, you know, he just hit you. What are you going to do? He just hit you. You have to hit him back. No, you have to think of ways in which to mitigate the conflict at its root. Mm. And that implies, you know, lots of things. I mean, Israel could have, after 2000, accepted the Clinton bridging parameters. It could have begun to help Palestinians invest in the creation of their own civil society. Lots of my friends in Ramallah have been saying, open the border, open the border. The border, if you have an open border, it's going to beat the tunnels and smuggling created by Hamas every time. Give us a chance to go in and build businesses with people in Gaza.
Bernie, you mentioned Clinton, the last serious attempt at a peace agreement under President Clinton at the end of the Oslo process, with another Clinton taking over the State Department. Is there any reason for hope here? I mean, I must say you sound extremely down about this, quite understandably. But as you look forward, is there a reason for some kind of turnaround or believe that another kind of process can take root here?
Well, look, let's say I'm down. I'm down because we're very close to tipping this whole area into a kind of Bosnia. I mean, this thing could get out of hand. Right now, Israel is sitting with what looks like an 8-day victory. But it's the kind of thing, you know, that could become extremely volatile and blow back into this region with West Bankers and also the Arabs of Israel getting involved. I don't think that Clinton herself is a kind of pivotal actor here. I think the real question is, you know, is Barack Obama going to follow through on his commitment to make the Israeli-Arab peace process a priority? And nothing would make me happier than for him to say that the Clinton bridging proposals are now American foreign policy.
Bernie, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
That's Bernard Avishai in Jerusalem. He's author most recently of The Hebrew Republic, How Secular Democracy and Global Enterprise Will Bring Israel Peace at Last. He also writes on politics and business for Harper's, among other publications. To get to his blog, go to our website, here-now.org. And coming up, from the stimulus package to the controversy over Barack Obama's former Senate seat, we'll preview the agenda for the new Congress. And later in the show, we'll check in with a California man who is riding his bike to the presidential inauguration. I guess you could say he's a real spokesperson for Barack Obama. Spokesperson, get it? It's Here and Now. Washington is back in business this week in a big way, with a new Congress being sworn in and a soon-to-be new president taking up residence at a hotel near the White House. With just 2 weeks before his inauguration, Barack Obama has at least one unexpected issue to grapple with. He has to pick a new Commerce Secretary following Bill Richardson's surprise withdrawal yesterday. Obama's transition has also been complicated by high-stakes showdowns involving two disputed U.S. Senate seats and signals that his economic recovery plan will take longer to pass than he'd like. In a recent letter to lawmakers, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wrote, "The opening days of the new Congress will be intense." Well, to help us sort through some of that intensity, we're joined by Gail Shattuck, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail joins us from the Monitor Radio Studio in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you, Gail. We'll talk about some specific issues in a moment, but give me your sort of overall take on where Obama and Congress stand in Washington this first week.
It's such a remarkable change of climate and tone. He's meeting today with Democrats in the morning, with Republicans in the afternoon. He's been making many, many phone calls on both sides of the aisle. Republicans are very happy to see any indication that despite the fact that they're coming back with much less clout on the numbers side, that they might yet be a factor in what happens in the next 4 years. Hmm. And that's the assurances that he's trying to send this week.
Well, let's talk about some specifics. We have 2 weeks to go before inauguration. What are some of the key issues that Congress is going to be focusing on over the next 2 weeks?
Everything takes second place to the stimulus plan. Mm. That's all I'm hearing people talk about. Not just stimulus, it's now economic recovery plan. But even Republicans who have been very concerned about a spending spree have been very reassured by the leaks that this is actually going to have a significant tax component to it. Republicans think that it's tax breaks that really create long-term competitiveness and that that's the important part.
And what else do we know about it? We know it's called, as you suggested, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Plan, mm-hmm. and I gather Obama's expected to offer an outline in a speech later this week. What do we know about some of the specifics beyond the tax component?
Well, he gave a very interesting clue in his radio address on Saturday. He said that the jobs are going to be created about 80% in the private sector and about 20% in the public sector. And that prompted the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, to say in an interview on Sunday talk show, yes, but 20%, that's still a lot. That's about 600,000 jobs. That's the size of the post office. Do we really want to go in that direction?
Hmm. Gail, we actually have Mitch McConnell on tape. I want to play that cut of tape just so our listeners can hear it. Then we'll come back and talk about it. Here's Mitch McConnell speaking yesterday on ABC's program with George Stephanopoulos.
First of all, the president, incoming president, has said he would like for 80% of the jobs created to be in the private sector. Well, do we really want to create 20% of the jobs in the public sector? That would be 600,000 new government jobs. That's about the size of the post office workforce. Is that a good idea? That's something that strikes us that we ought to take a look at.
So, Gail, is that reflective of Republican concerns about the proposed stimulus package?
Yes, it is. The overall concern is this. Are we moving toward an economy that is so dependent on government that it will never be quite the same again? Are we becoming like a European country where the important decisions in the economy are made by a bureaucrat, either at the national or the European level? But I think it may be missing something. This is actually what I'm working on right now. You know, if you follow what's happening at the state level, the state cutbacks that are anticipated just in the next few months are staggering. They've gone from $200 billion shortfall just a few weeks ago to $350 billion. Now, a lot of that is public sector jobs. So it'll be interesting to know whether some of the jobs that the president-elect is talking about isn't just a new job freshly minted, but it's saving a job that otherwise might be lost. Hmm. And I suspect a lot of those will be at the state level.
Let's turn to these Senate seats that are still up in the air, and there are several. There's Obama's Illinois seat. There's the Al Franken-Norm Coleman battle still underway in Minnesota. And then, of course, there's Hillary Clinton's seat in New York, which Caroline Kennedy says she wants. Strange way to begin a congressional session with so many seats up in the air, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And then we have Senator Biden, who will still be casting votes until the inauguration. His seat is going to be replaced, too, and will it be eventually replaced by his son? Is that part of what he's setting up? So there are a lot of curious things in the run-up to this campaign. But the one that we're all watching is what is going to happen to that Illinois seat.
Mm. Yeah, there was speculation last week that the man appointed to fill Obama's Senate seat, who is Roland Burris, might actually make it onto the Senate floor despite the objections of Democrats because of the man who appointed him, Governor Rod Blagojevich. And here's what Burris told the AP recently.
The appointment of the governor of Illinois is legal. I am the United States Senator, the junior senator from Illinois. All of the other issues are just distractions.
What do you think? All the other issues are just distractions, or is this story a distraction?
Well, this is a very, very big issue for Democrats. The last thing they want is to start this new era of change looking like the corruption scandals that the Republicans had, which is why I think the majority leader, Harry Reid, jumped way out ahead of this. Remember, he's declaring that it's a tainted nomination even before there's an indictment of the governor. We heard the prosecutor said on Saturday that he might need a few more months to even make that case. So it's tough. I haven't heard a single word against Mr. Burris himself, but Democrats want to run very far from the impression that they are corrupt, as some of the Republicans have been.
Well, it's an interesting story, and we'll be following it closely. And Gail Chadwick, thanks so much for helping us sort through this first couple of weeks of the new Congress. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Gail Chadwick. She's congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. It's Here and Now. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Before the break, we were talking about the new Congress and the work it faces. One of the items on the agenda is the House ethics probe against Democrat Charles Rangel. The New York congressman chairs the powerful Ways and Means Committee, and he's facing a number of allegations involving donations and unreported income. Our next guest says Democrats will have to decide what to do about Congressman Rangel. If he's guilty, he says it would be a mistake to simply punish Rangel without also addressing the underlying issues that have been raised again by the scandal. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He wrote about this recently on CNN.com, and he joins us now from the Princeton studios to talk about it. And Julian, welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You write, of course, that the backdrop to this case, as we mentioned, is the case involving Congressman Rangel. Remind us what the issues are. What are the charges against him?
Well, Rangel is powerful. He's the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and there's been a number of accusations made about him. One is that he helped solicit money for a school that's going to be named in his honor in New York using official letterhead. There are accusations that people who receive tax benefits from the Ways and Means Committee, a prominent lobbyist in particular, has made donations to this school. There's also charges about a villa, unreported income from a villa that he has abroad, and then also questions about several rent-controlled apartments that he has in Harlem, and other kind of stories have emerged. I'm not sure which are officially in the investigation, but those are some of the big allegations that are out there.
And what's at stake for Congressman Rangel? What could happen if the Ethics Committee finds him guilty of these allegations?
Well, he could clearly lose his chairmanship, which is, the bread and butter of what a congressperson does. He could lose his Ways and Means chairmanship, and, worse professionally would be to be forced either to resign or to lose re-election to Congress. And then, obviously, there's always the potential for some kind of criminal investigation, which has happened as well with previous congressmen. So from the legal to the professional, I think if these are true, he is in some jeopardy.
Hmm. It's interesting. You write about some of the history. There's a lot of history in this particular behind this particular case. Other Ways and Means Committee chairmen have gotten into trouble in the past. We can talk about people like Wilbur Mills and his protege Dan Rostenkowski. Tell us about them, and what is it about this position that seems to lead to these kinds of abuses of power?
Yeah, it has a bit of a sordid history. Wilbur Mills was the chairman in the 60s and early 70s, very powerful. He was brought down in 1974 by a sex scandal involving his relationship with a stripper named the Argentinian firecracker. But he was also under attack for also campaign contributions that he had received from powerful interest groups that did business with the Ways and Means Committee, like the milk industry. He was also a target of many younger Democrats like Henry Waxman for abusing the power of the chairmanship and stifling reform and energies in areas such as energy and the treatment of oil. Dan Rostenkowski is also brought down in 1994 because he comes under charges for all sorts of ethics reforms, padding the payroll, hiring friends and people from his district, buying things at the House stationery store for constituents, and kind of engaging in old-school ethical unethical practices after people expected more of legislators. And so he loses his seat in 1994 and ultimately serves time in prison. So those are two examples where some of the things that are at least circulating about Rangel have been the problem for previous chairmen.
And is it that these, I mean, what leads to this, do you suspect? I mean, is it that these chairmanships are just too powerful for anyone to or for many people to resist these kinds of abuses?
There's kind of three parts of it. Part is the personal and the story of these individuals. Some of them just choose to do the wrong thing. A second, yes, this is an extraordinarily powerful position within the House of Representatives. So the saying that power corrupts, I think, is fitting. And I think it's very hard for many individuals to avoid the temptations that come with this seat. But third, and what I wrote about, there are underlying problems with the ethics system, with the campaign finance system of Congress that don't only put pressure on the House of Ways and Means Committee, but on all members of Congress, and are often core issues in the kinds of scandal stories we hear about. The fact our campaigns are financed through private money always allows lobbyists and interest groups to have extraordinary power. The fact there is no independent monitor on congressional ethics is perpetually a problem because congressmen and women are essentially policing themselves.
So is Congress going to get serious this time about addressing this? Do you have any confidence that some of these underlying issues beyond just punishing Congressman Rangel, if he is found to be guilty of these breaches, are they going to get serious about some kind of reform?
Well, they could. I mean, here is a president-elect now who campaigned on the promise of change. Here's a Democratic Congress who came into power in 2006, you know, in part because of all the corruption problems that Republicans had faced. And there's a lot of stories now from the Illinois Senate seat to Congressman Rangel that are putting ethics front and center of the agenda at a time Democrats want to be focused on the economy and also on foreign policy. So, you know, I doubt we'll have totally sweeping reform. This is just not, there's not evidence that's going to happen. But if these stories continue, it's going to be hard for Democrats to sit and do nothing. And I think they're also aware of the political costs that they might incur if that's their strategy.
Well, it seems like talk of reform is a perennial issue. Every new administration, every new Congress, every election cycle brings with it talk of reform and a need for reform. You know, what would be sort of the number one or maybe the top two measures to reform this system that you would like to see take place?
I think Congress, the one thing they always punt on whenever we have moments on reform is a strong independent commission will monitor what's going on in ethics and that will have large responsibility over determining wrongdoing. I think there's limits to what House and Senate ethics committees can do. The political incentives are just all against, you know, substantive monitoring of this kind of activity. So I think a very strong independent commission should be something that is considered. And two, and this is the hardest one, campaign finance. You know, one of the successful reforms we had was the Watergate public finance system for presidential elections from 1974 through the 1980s. It worked pretty well. Now it's being dismantled. President-elect Obama didn't really use it. But for a while, it limited the role of private money in the presidential contests. And I think we need to look into how Congress receives money for its campaigns if we're ever going to diminish the power of these interest groups.
Well, Julian Zelizer, thanks so much for talking about the need for reform, and we'll certainly keep our eye on this story as the months go forward.
Thank you.
That's Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. He's also co-editor of Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. And before we go today, when the mentally ill create art, then give it away, who does it belong to, the artist or his heirs? You're listening to Here and Now. Close to 3 million people are expected to converge on Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of Barack Obama as the country's 44th president later this month. Most will come by airplane, bus, car, or train, but at least one person will be arriving on his bicycle all the way from Los Angeles. Ryan Bowen left his home in L.A. about a month ago. He's been riding about 85 miles a day, and he plans to make it to Washington in time for the inauguration. And Ryan joins us now. And Ryan, where are you today?
I am in Madison, Florida, about 60 miles east of Tallahassee, on my way to Lake City, Florida, and then to Jacksonville.
Okay, Ryan, Florida, you're coming from L.A. You're going to Washington, D.C. I got to ask, did you not bring a roadmap?
Did I not bring? I happen to have one, and I got a bunch of maps from the Adventure Cycling Association, actually, and they took me on the southern route to avoid all the northern blizzard weather that we've been seeing all over the United States. So I've been staying south through New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, and now I'm in Florida. So I've been encountering really good weather.
I see. So then you'll head north up the East Coast and get to Washington. If you're lucky, you won't encounter too much winter weather, but it probably is going to get a little chillier for you.
You know, that was the first warning that everybody said was for the cold, and so that was what I got first, was all my winter weather gear. So I'm prepared.
So tell us why you're doing this. Are you an avid biker, or is there something else going on here?
You know, honestly, I hadn't ridden my bike more than 20 miles in a day before I left. I commute in Los Angeles. But really the reason behind this was because I was inspired by the Obama campaign and what I think is that we have a real potential for a progressive political change coming up. I don't think that it's going to happen just by sitting back on our laurels and saying that we elected a black president. So one of the ways that I think that we can bring this change that he talked about bringing to Washington is by changing the mode of transportation that people take. And so I'm taking an unconventional means of getting to D.C. by riding my bicycle.
Now, I understand you're a photographer and that you've been documenting your ride with photographs and that you've been interviewing people along the way about what kind of change they want to see from an Obama administration. What are you hearing from people out there?
You know what? In every city and state that I've gone through, we talk about these red and blue states. And regardless of where I've been, you know, Barack Obama is our next president, and it doesn't really matter if it's a partisan issue or not. People are optimistic and hopeful for a brighter future.
But are you hearing anything specific about what needs to happen? I mean, a lot of folks out there, out of jobs, worried about a sour economy. Are they talking about any kind of policy prescriptions that they'd like to see put into effect?
You know, one of the biggest fears that I have heard from folks is that Barack Obama could just be an emperor in new clothes. You know, we don't want to see somebody come in with a face of change and just be a symbol for what's already been going on for years, you know. So what people have been saying is that we can't rest back on just listening to the rhetoric of any campaign. But people are generally concerned about the economy, about employment, looking forward to possible renewable energy programs that could be providing more jobs in our energy market.
Ryan, we mentioned that you're averaging about 85 miles a day. I guess your biggest day was about 150 miles. Did you do a lot of training to prepare for this?
You know what? I finished 151 yesterday, and I'm pretty sore today. I trained one day. I rode about 110 miles from Los Angeles to San Diego and took the bus back and was sore for about the whole 2 weeks until I took off on my journey on December 2nd. So there was no major training that went in. I wasn't much of an avid bicyclist. I didn't have the click-in shoes or, you know, even a bike. I got the bike donated, and that's what's really been giving me the energy to promote this trip, is that people have been supporting me in multiple ways, financially, by providing their homes to stay at, as well as this bicycle that was donated by a nice gentleman in Los Angeles.
So let's fast forward to January 21st, the day after Obama's inauguration. Will you be getting on your bike and bicycling all the way back to Los Angeles?
You know, I've had an enjoyable experience enough that I would like to ride back across the country someday. As for January 21st, I'm planning to stay on the East Coast while we finish up the documentary that we're making, and also contacting many of the individuals that have been inspired by this trip and want to connect and build off of this and see where we can take this Biking for Obama movement of sorts.
That's Ryan Bowen. He's riding his bicycle to President-elect Barack Obama's inauguration in Washington, D.C. He started at his home in Los Angeles in early December. Ryan, thanks so much for talking to us, and good luck.
Thank you, Anthony.
And you can see photos of Ryan's ride on our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Here's a question. Should museums, art galleries, and private collectors be able to keep, trade, or sell art created by the mentally ill when the artist's family wants the work back? That's at the heart of what could be a precedent-setting court case in California concerning the works of Martin Ramirez, a Mexican immigrant who died in 1963. Ramirez, who was diagnosed with schizophrenia, spent more than 30 years in California psychiatric hospitals, where he taught himself how to paint and draw. Some of the artworks he created during that time are now selling for six figures, and some of them are currently being displayed at the American Folk Museum and the Rico Maresca Gallery in New York City. But now Ramirez's heirs are taking legal action to get them back. From New York, John Kalish reports.
Martin Ramirez used matchsticks to apply his colors, subdued reds, yellows, and blues. Many of his paintings are in sheets of examining table paper, some of them 18 feet long. He depicts trains running in and out of tunnels, cars morphing into turtles, a Madonna standing on a globe with a snake coiled at her feet, and men on horses holding pistols. Many of these images are framed by lines, says Brooke Davis Anderson, a curator at the American Museum of Folk Art in Manhattan.
Ramirez was an artist who loved line above all. What's probably most compelling about those lines is the way that they're repeated across a page, often looking like a fingerprint because they are enlarged, parallel, circular lines drawn one above another.
Ramirez surely could not have imagined that one of his drawings would sell for more than $300,000 someday, or that New York Times art critic Roberta Smith would declare he was simply one of the greatest artists of the 20th century. But curator Brooke Davis Anderson isn't surprised at all that Martin Ramirez has become a big deal in the art world.
He hasn't been under the radar to the critical community and to the community studying and focusing on self-taught artists and their work. I'm not surprised at all that Roberta Smith called him one of the greatest artists of the 20th century. Those of us who've been studying this material for decades have been feeling that way for a long time.
Some 100 Ramirez artworks that were unknown until last year are now on display at the American Folk Art Museum and the Rico Maresca Gallery in New York. A California woman was preparing to auction off 17 other previously unknown Ramirez drawings at Sotheby's this year, but the auction was called off after two of Ramirez's grandchildren objected. Maureen Hammond was a young graduate student when she was sent those 17 Ramirez drawings by a psychologist who was visiting Ramirez in the hospital. The psychologist was Tarmo Pasto, who collected hundreds of Ramirez's artworks between 1948 and 1963, the year Ramirez died. Ms. Hammond is quite upset.
This was an unsolicited gift. Tarmo Pasto sent this to me. This is my property. Do they have any right to my property? No, they don't.
Ramirez's heirs do have a right to the art, argues Christopher Claytel, one of the lawyers representing the family.
California law simply did not contemplate transfers of the personal property of involuntarily committed persons in state mental hospitals, except via the appointment of a guardian or pursuant to public auction procedures that were set forth in California law. Those are the two ways in which an involuntarily committed mental patient in a state mental hospital could have property transferred. Neither one of those avenues occurred here.
Lawyers for Maureen Hammond contend that Ramirez allowed Pasto to take his paintings. That is supported by James Durfee, who worked as a psychiatric nurse at one of the state hospitals where Ramirez was committed.
Every two or three days, he brought me one of his finished artworks to my office. I had been told to collect them by my supervisor. I would have them collected in a locker. Tarmo Pasto came once a year. And then he would meet with Martin. So I know Martin knew he took him.
Durfee, who is now 79, says none of the Ramirez paintings were displayed on the ward, which was home to men who suffered from tuberculosis. He remembers seeing many of them thrown away. Ramirez, it turns out, made his own paint by grinding up crayons and mixing them with his own sputum, causing most of the staff on the ward to avoid handling his finished paintings. Some of these works were mailed to the Ramirez family back in Mexico. Kristen Espinosa, a Chicago-based Ramirez scholar, says the family also disposed of his work.
The drawings that the family received, they kept them very private because of Ramirez's mental illness, which was a huge shame at that time. Juanita, Ramirez's oldest daughter, told us that she didn't really see them as art. They meant something to her for personal reasons because they were her father's. So they kept the drawings, and the drawings sort of deteriorated, and then they ended up destroying them.
In Europe, there's a tradition of establishing museums affiliated with psychiatric hospitals and displaying the artwork of mental patients. The prolific Swiss psychiatric patient and artist Adolf Wolfli is a case in point. The prominent Canadian artist, William Kurlick, was confined in a British psychiatric facility for a while. His famous painting, The Maze, which was used in a Time Life book and as album cover art by Van Halen, is now in the collection of the Bethlehem Royal Hospital Archives and Museum in England. Rebecca Hofberger of the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore says it's worth noting that Kurlick's heirs haven't tried to make a grab for The Maze.
His estate could come and say, hey, that's probably one of the most valuable pieces ever. We want it. And it hasn't happened. Maybe because they realize that the museum does cherish it. It was made when he was a patient. It's part of their history as well.
Many observers are wondering whether the Ramirez heirs are going to confront the Whitney Museum in New York, which was given 10 Ramirez drawings by Tarmo Pasto in the 1950s. The Whitney will not comment on the prospects for litigation, but Janet Marstein, an authority on museum ethics at Seton Hall University, says that if the estate does come calling, the museum has a duty to negotiate with the family.
When the artist does not have the capacity to make these decisions for him or herself, the museum has a responsibility to mediate these things with the family, with the estate of the artist. This is an ethical obligation that the museum has.
Museums have been eager to acquire a Ramirez work ever since the recent batch of more than 100 drawings surfaced last year. The Rico Maresca Gallery's Frank Maresca says that since his current show opened in October, museums have been calling.
Three really wonderful works were donated to the American Folk Art Museum. A great work was just acquired by the Newark Museum. And I can tell you that other very major museums all over the world are in the process of acquiring.
Maresca's gallery, by the way, was one of more than 40 that bid for the right to sell the recently unearthed Ramirez works. It has sold dozens so far. The cheapest has gone for $50,000. The most expensive has a price tag of more than $300,000.
That's producer John Kalish in New York. Well, the new year brings new things, and it's brought Here and Now new listeners in the Buckeye State. So we'd like to say hello to a whole bunch of new listeners in Ohio who are tuning in to WGTE 91.3 FM in Toledo, WGLE in Lima, WGBE in Bryan, and WGDE in Defiance, Ohio. Welcome aboard. And for all of you Ohio State football fans, good luck tonight in the Fiesta Bowl. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. Join us again tomorrow, Here and Now.